Over the past several weeks, parts of northern Illinois have been deluged with rain. Thousands of homes, businesses, schools, and other buildings are flooded. Several counties have been named state disaster areas. And the forecast is calling for even more rain this week. We'll check in with some of the areas most affected across northern Illinois. Plus, school's out, but the achievement gap keeps growing over the summer when some parents can send their kids to academic programs that others can't afford.
Certainly at its core is the issue of poverty and the disparity in income and resources available.
And the clock is ticking for legislators to send a school funding bill to Governor Rauner.
All of us in Illinois, taxpayers, have been funding Chicago extra money, in large part because Chicago pays its own teacher pension.
The latest showdown on state spending and the schools, that's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in for Nyla Budu today. It's exactly what flooded areas across northern Illinois didn't need yesterday, even more rain. Heavy storms have dumped rain on the region for weeks. Thousands of buildings have been affected by flooding. Governor Bruce Rauner issued a state disaster declaration for parts of Cook, Kane, Lake, and McHenry counties. We're going to get an update on the flooding across that area here from one school principal trying to figure out how to open the doors for the new school year after all this flooding. First, Aaron Lawler chairs the Lake County Board. He joins us now by phone. Aaron, thanks for talking with us today. Must be a busy week for you.
It is, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. So the Fox River had finally started to drop a little, then more storms came through last night. The area has kind of seen continuous rain, really, since flooding began. Where are we at right now? How do things look?
Well, floodwaters continue to recede, and while I think myself and every resident in Lake County, the minute we see yet another raindrop, we have cause for concern. But while the downpours were heavy in spots, we didn't see significant enough rain to really drive the water levels up along our major waterways.
Okay, so some of those storms came through. They moved through fairly quickly. They didn't dump that much water, so it hasn't affected what is already a bad situation. It hasn't made it at least not much worse.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So what? I mean, what are
so really the focus is now on, you know, really response and recovery, cleanup. We've got. We had well over 6,000 homes along our rivers and waterways that were impacted, as well as a number of homes that were fell victim to flash flooding, which came on very sudden and due to the amount of rain overwhelmed the storm sewers. And that's where we saw another approximately 4,000 homes throughout the county that are not next to waterways flooded as well.
Yeah, and I mean, flash flood, that can be very dangerous. I mean, roads and homes and things. Are we talking, have we heard of any injuries, any people killed by this flooding?
No, fortunately, we have not heard of any major health issues. The only one I saw was on the 10 o'clock news. Somebody had injured their finger, potentially lost a finger based on some cleanup work, but no major deaths. Injuries or anything of that sort, so we're very thankful for that.
Yeah, and similarly, I mean, I remember reading one, there was a sort of a close call that happened. I think it was a boat trying to get through, got stuck under a bridge as the floodwaters were coming up, but they also were able to be rescued. So primarily right now, what you're hearing, we're talking about property damage, and not at all to make light of that, but property damage and to most of the areas that you're seeing right now.
Yeah, so we're in the middle of our damage assessment. We just had our morning briefing, which focused largely on the damage assessment. The county's compiled about 149 pages worth of damage reports for the work that we've done in the unincorporated areas that we're responsible for, as well as any areas and municipalities that we were called in to assist. And so we'll be compiling those damage reports with our municipalities to see how much basically in overtime, sandbag costs, all those types of things that go into this were incurred, and then hopefully get some reimbursement from the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Yeah, once it's all compiled. So that process here, just sort of getting underway, it sounds like. We're talking about the flooding across large parts of northern Illinois here. Mike Warner directs the Lake County Stormwater Management Commission. He's also on the phone with us here this morning. Mike, also have a lot on your plate. Thanks for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us on.
Can you kind of put this in a geographic context for us just real quickly? You know, we're talking about a large area of northern Illinois. You've got the Fox River, Des Plaines River, some other waterways. You know, for those of us in other parts of the state, where is this flooding primarily happening?
Well, right now, the worst areas are along the Fox River. And as you know, several counties got declared disaster areas, not just Lake, but all going down the Fox River. You got Henry County, Kane County as well. And then Cook also got hit with the Des Plaines River. So I heard you mention flash flooding before, and there was, I think, 6 inches of rain in just a few hours, which flash flooded many homes.
Yeah.
It was an incredible amount of water. And overall, I think it was over 8 inches in north of us in the Fox River. And so that's kind of how we got here. And so the storms that are hitting now aren't welcome, but if it's a half inch or, you know, around that, it's not going to bring us up where we were before as far as flood levels.
Okay. So some I hesitate to use the word positive, but some at least not more bad news. And Mike, I mean, so these rivers, they weren't just a little bit flooded. I mean, how far above flood stage have some of these rivers gone?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. On the northern Fox River, just as it comes into Lake County, that gauge set a new record that was, I think, over 2 feet above the old record. So it wasn't even close. It was just, you know, a new record, and we hope to not see that again. On the Plains, we also hit a new record in the village of Gurnee, and that one stood since 1986, I believe. So, you know, it's record flooding across the county.
Yeah, across, and not, like you said, not just that county, but a number of counties throughout that region there. So you're on the ground, you know, Lake County Stormwater Management Commission there. What are some of the ways that the agency and others there are coordinating to deal with this?
Well, I was going to say, when I let off, you know, you mentioned about the fact that no one was hurt, you know, seriously. And I got to say, the first responders have been incredible. Fire, police, very busy in the first few days of the storm. And I think it's largely on their part is why no one got seriously injured. There's a lot of rescues, a lot of closed roads, and folks driving into areas that they didn't realize were flooded and had to get rescued from vehicles. So a lot of that was going on. The Lake County Emergency Management Agency took the lead, and Aaron and a lot of people jumped to lead this effort and the recovery. And it's been just amazing how across the board everyone's responded.
Yeah, the first responders, you're right, the first one putting themselves at risk to go out and try to make sure that everybody else is safe in all of this. And you mentioned sort of the recovery, and that's the voice of Mike Warner, Lake County Stormwater Management Commission Director. Also on the line, Aaron Lawler, Lake County Board Chairman. And taking a closer look now at some of the recovery efforts going on, Phil Georgia is principal of a Murphy Elementary School around Lake Park. It was hit hard by these floods. Also joins us here on the line. And Phil, I appreciate you talking with us too.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
I read that, Murphy, that your school at one point had 4 feet of water at one point. How are things looking now?
Looking really good. We were really a victim of the flash flooding that was just discussed. We're kind of in a little bit of a bowl in Round Lake Park, and with most of the storms that we get, the village can pump out all the extra water that comes in. But we had so much coming in with that two-day time frame of just heavy storms that it overwhelmed the pumps and actually knocked out the power panel. And then after that, there was just nowhere that the water could go. So, we were 4 feet underwater.
And so what kind of damage does that kind of water do in a school?
Well, we had our library was completely wiped out. Our computer lab that's on that lower level was also completely wiped out. We have 4 classrooms down there, our gym and cafeteria, and our music room.
So that's a lot. Computer labs,
main areas of the building affected.
Libraries. In terms of the physical infrastructure, are you worried about opening in August?
Well, we're making amazing strides. It's been incredible. It took about 4 days just for the water to recede from the building where we could actually get in and start some of that restoration work. Our insurance and the restoration company that we've been have been absolutely amazing. And our facilities department has been working night and day just doing incredible work. You know, we're hoping to start really close to the beginning of school. They've been able to get in there, suck out all the water and mud. There's carpets been ripped out, drywall's been ripped out. The restoration company has brought in huge machines just to pump hot air into the building to dry it out. And as soon as the air quality is okay and repairs have been made to the AC and vents have been cleaned and moisture levels are where they're supposed to be, we're hoping to be ready to start school.
So things are drying out at this point. The water has been pumped out. You mentioned, though, the computer lab. You mentioned libraries. A lot of need right there. How has the community responded right now to that?
The community has come out with amazing support. We've had, just our local community, a lot of partnerships here in Round Lake, organizations that have reached out to us. The biggest thing that we've been running is a book drive. We want to start the school year to have books on hand for kids. And so even though we're covered by insurance and we're expecting to, have a full library replaced, we know that teaching kids without books on that first day that they come is going to be really hard. And so we've had donations from all over the state even. Book companies, I got a call even from California last week where a publisher had seen that we were had flooding, and they were like, we're just going to send you all these leveled readers.
Oh, wow.
So that's something we'll be able to just put in the teacher's hands the first day of school.
Nice. I mean, if people are listening right now, if they want to help, how do they do that? What should they know?
Probably the best thing to do is to check out the Facebook page for either our district or for the Murphy Elementary School. And we've got, we've listed on there where book donations can be dropped off. The Round Lake School District Foundation is collecting funds for people who are just looking for a way to give. It's an organization that helps us do programs and opportunities for kids above and beyond what we normally offer. And then the Murphy teachers, when they first heard about the flooding, I think they were really worried about themselves, and then they heard that insurance was going to cover everything. They started a GoFundMe page for the families in our community. And they realized, the greater need is going to be all of our neighbors that were flooded and have lost way more than we have as a school.
Right. So it sounds like quite an outpouring here. That's Phil Georgia, principal of Murphy Elementary School in Round Lake Park, hit hard by the flooding. They are drying out, and there's some of the ways there that you can help out as they look to open their doors soon. Phil, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mike Warner, I want to come back to you for a minute. One of the things we've been hearing about is the standing water that's going out. There are health concerns, and as you look at recovery and cleanup and the pumping like he was talking about, there are some concerns there. There are standing water, can be a breeding ground for mosquitoes, some other health issues. What kind of steps are you guys taking there?
Well, the Lake County Health Department has taken some efforts to make people aware of that. There is a big crop of mosquitoes coming out right now, and so there are warnings out there on how to protect yourself from mosquitoes. You can visit their website. There's a lot of good tips. There's also, I guess what they call mosquito donuts that are dunks that you can put in any standing water that you can't get rid of right now, and it's a larvicide that'll help cut down on the number of mosquitoes that thrive. So that is a concern, and
those are things people can do on their own if they have some water near them or whatnot. They can take care of those that kind of thing at the store and drop that in.
Exactly. So you can get those at like a hardware store and throw it in there if it's not water that you can easily get rid of.
Okay. And Mike, one more here just for you. There is some more rain in the forecast later this week. The percentage kind of varies depending on what you look at. A slight chance in the next few days. But you mentioned any time drops sort of fall from the sky, it raises concerns. What are you all keeping an eye on right now?
I think the forecast right now is a few days out, and it's probably less than an inch right now. So, again, it's kind of four steps forward and one step back when you hit a rain of that height or that amount. So as you watch the river gauges fall in Fox Lake, of course, they can't fall fast enough, but we're seeing about a tenth of a foot drop per day, which isn't a lot, but it's a huge chain of lakes, huge water body. We are making progress. And so, for example, there was about a half inch yesterday, and you see a little blip on the receding end of the hydrograph, where it comes back up for a little bit and then starts going back down. So, again, half an inch we can deal with. It's not welcome. But
you guys are really watching those radars, it sounds like, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Aaron Lawler, Lake County Board Chairman, just coming back to you for the last minute here. But for those who are listening, maybe they're in Lake County, maybe across the Rock River region, the Des Plaines River region there, who may have to head that way in coming days, who have business or homes there or whatnot. What do you want people to know right now?
Well, right now we're in the damage assessment and recovery mode, and I think it's important for folks to be checking on their neighbors. We've seen so many wonderful stories of people helping out, communities pitching in, but there are going to be lasting effects of this flood, like the mosquitoes that you mentioned. Right now we expect to see what you call nuisance mosquitoes being hatched for the next 4 to 6 weeks. Following that, you're going to see the mosquito that carries the West Nile virus starting to hatch. So it's important
that breed of mosquito,
be draining their standing water, to be using, the mosquito repellent with DEET, and so forth. But also, one of the things we talked about is the mental toll that this takes. There's clearly a financial toll, but we need to make sure that we're checking on our friends, our relatives, our neighbors to make sure that they're getting through this very tough time, and also protecting themselves from scam artists. There are some terrible people out there that every time a situation like this arises, choose to try and take advantage of folks in their darkest hour. And so it's important that if people are contacted by a cleanup company or a similar business,
do the Better Business Bureau.
Yeah, they're not required to.
Aaron, I'm sorry, we are out of time here, but we can certainly post more information for information on that to the Better Business Bureau and others for people to protect themselves. It's a really good point.
LakeCountyIL.gov/flood. All the information's up there.
Aaron Lawler, Lake County Board Chairman. Mike Warner, Lake County Stormwater Management Commission Director. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, we know that there are big disparities between lower income and higher income public schools in terms of achievement, but that gap doesn't stop growing when school is out. When higher income parents send their kids to museums, academic summer camps that other parents can't afford, it can make it even harder for lower income students to catch up. Joining me now to learn about this from Springfield is Sarah Boyning. She's the board president of Compass for Kids. They provide academic support summer camps for low-income kids in the Springfield area. Also here in our Urbana studio is Bill Trent, professor of education and director of the Center for Education in Small Urban Communities at the University of Illinois. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Sarah, let me start with you. So you've got Compass for Kids. It's a camp there in the Springfield area. It's more than a camp, but you can explain that. But is there an example? Is there somebody who you're seeing this summer who kind of brings to mind a lot of things that we're talking about and sort of the benefits of coming to a camp like Compass for Kids?
We have Camp Compass, which is our summer program, and it serves the elementary age students from District 186 who are referred through the schools. And while I personally am not there at camp every day, so I don't have those personal stories to tell, we know from past years, from the pre- and post-camp testing, that the students who attend the camp have between 80 and into the 90% maintaining and improving in math and reading over the course of our camp in the summer.
Whereas, you see those outcomes really clearly. Huh?
Yes, and without that intervention, we find that, especially in reading, the gap between students from affluent families and students from more at-risk, impoverished families, it grows. Maybe they lose 2 months of math skills and 2 to 3 months in reading over the summer without this kind of intervention.
So, and we'll talk more about that here in a moment with Bill Trent as well, but what kinds of resources does Compass for Kids provide? What goes on there for students and for parents over the summer?
Camp Compass tries to remove all the barriers to participation for the at-risk children. So we do things like we provide the full school day length for the camp. It's 6 weeks long. We provide busing so all the students can come and not have a transportation barrier. It's free to the families. The students don't pay tuition. It's offered as a free service. They get food, breakfast, snacks, lunch. And then every morning they have licensed teachers who provide the academic enrichment. In the afternoons they have other enrichment like arts and sports and swimming lessons and really fun field trips. And so there's definitely a lot of learning going on, but there's also a lot of that summer experience that helps them relate better when they get back to school with the children from families that can afford their children to go to camp that these children otherwise would not be able to attend.
So kind of combining the learning experience with also that more kind of fun summer camp type experience. Are there, you know, unique needs in the Springfield area that are addressing that are different from the rest of the state? Or do you find that this model is something that would be applicable, you know, really across the state and region?
We think the model is widely applicable, but we certainly see a need, a homeless student, Asher student need here in Springfield that needs attention.
Yeah, we're talking about some of the ways to address the summer learning loss, particularly some of the disparities that we see in the achievement gap between students, you know, all across the country, really. But we're focused here on Illinois today. Bill Trent, also in the studio, professor here at the University of Illinois. You know, and Bill, there is a lot of research on this. You know, I'm thinking there was one statistic I read that said by fifth grade, summer learning loss can leave lower-income kids 2.5 to 3 years behind their higher-income classmates. That's just the summer learning loss aspect of it. That data from the National Summer Learning Association. What can you kind of pull back the curtain here? Just what's driving this?
Many of the factors that have already been suggested or identified, particularly by the by Sarah's description of the program that they are that they have developed. At its core is the issue of poverty and the impact that it has on being able to provide those kids, those families, those communities with the kinds of experiences during the summer that are developmentally appropriate and academically and intellectually valuable because there are real costs associated with it. The research is pretty clear, and there have been a number of strategies that people have used to address this, primarily focusing on the issue of literacy. But certainly at its core is the issue of poverty and the disparity in income and resources available. It's particularly difficult when school districts across the state of Illinois, but nationally also, are confronted with deteriorating budgets, smaller budgets, lower allocations.
And wide having disparities in property tax
exactly.
And other things too.
So the gap between the northern districts in the state and the southernmost districts can be astronomical, considering what the students' needs are and what the schools' needs are.
And can you paint a picture there? I mean, what does that then look like? You know, with those disparities in the schools, with the poverty things we're talking about, how does that play out in classrooms, you know, in homes? What does it actually look like in Illinois?
Well, I'll give you a local district. I won't name the district, but it's a district that has undergone substantial changes in the economic structure of that city. Small town, but it's had dramatic changes. And the number of families that have encountered poverty has increased substantially. And so you have a situation where parents, as we know, with the challenge of being able to find a living wage, are compensating by working multiple jobs. Both parents are doing that, and in those instances where there's only one parent, that parent is doing that. And that creates the issue of the effective time that parents have to engage their students mm-hmm. in developmental activities, whether that's in reading, social activities, recreational activities.
Yeah, I mean, if you're working two or three jobs, you're not going to have time to sit down and read that book at night or to pick up that kid after.
Or the energy to do
or
it.
Or fair point, yeah.
Because the same demands are there for household maintenance. And so children, we have to have agencies step in. And in some instances, many of the agencies are doing what they can. The Boys and Girls Clubs across the country would be one of those kinds of agencies that attempt to step in and provide both after school, during the school year, and summer experiences for students that get them occupied, get them academically engaged, mm-hmm. All of which contributes to filling in that gap that the resources that parents don't have. Now, it's not just that the families don't have the resources. What Illinois has been going through for the past 2 years, yeah. means that many of our social agencies also don't have the resources to develop the kinds of interventions or to sustain them that would be available had we had the kinds of budgetary resources.
So we have seen a real hit by this budget standoff has had an impact.
Absolutely.
On somebody. Sarah, just to bring you in here real quick on this, have you seen an impact from the state budget there with what you're doing in Springfield?
Well, the Compass program is not funded directly by any state funding, so we haven't had that impact. But we are funded with very generous grants from the United Way, other community organizations, and many individuals. And so when the economy in Springfield is impacted, obviously the amount that we can expect people to be able to donate to us and, you know, granting organizations to have for us, that concerns us. But
and did you find that the need grew, too, because some of these other social service agencies and things were not able to provide other services, even in schools that we've seen? Programs have been cut, things like that. Is there a growing need, a growing reliance on what you're providing?
I believe there is, and some of the organizations that in the past we've been able to partner with to provide additional services to our students, some of those aren't available to us anymore, and which is a true shame because we love partnering and collaborating with other organizations.
And your resources are the same. They're essentially flat right now.
Well, we're a pretty new nonprofit, so we're still growing and ramping up. But yes, I mean, we've seen that most of our United Way funding has stayed flat for the last few years.
You know, Bill, just coming back here and getting at some of this broader picture that you were painting a little bit, you know, this conversation, it comes here in the context of lots of other conversations about ethnicity, race, income, disparities when it comes to education. You know, I guess the question I want to ask is there a policy solution to this problem, summer learning loss that we're talking about, you know, that can only address that one thing, or does any real solution have to take on these larger issues that you've been talking about?
Well, there are both. What we've seen many school districts do and what the research identifies are the different ways, especially in addressing this issue of the reading gap and its impact on the achievement gap. There are efforts that have shown promise whereby researchers established a research program that had students receive a dozen books at the end of the school year. Books that they had identified that they would want to read. Mm-hmm. So for the cost of about $45 per student, they were able to provide the students with these books, and the actual growth in literacy and literacy skills during that summer period for those students, in contrast to the students who did not receive those materials, mm-hmm. was pretty impressive.
So for relatively low cost there, I mean, you can make a significant difference.
That's the point, that we can just an intervention of providing the materials makes a huge difference in terms of summer reading loss. School districts, from a policy standpoint, across the country, different school districts have experimented with different manipulations of the school calendar. So we have everything from year-round schools to other configurations where they haven't fundamentally gone to a year-round program, but they have staged it differently in order to reduce the out-of-school time that students and their families
experience.
Yeah,
and hopefully that learning loss will be
precisely.
Less.
So you have some programs that are 90 days on, 30 days off, that sort of structure, which that too has shown promise.
So that helps too.
So in terms of thinking about efforts that school districts can undertake, there are ways in which we can alter the school calendar in a way that's effective for having a positive impact on that summer learning loss. The challenge there is obvious. You've got to keep the buildings open during the summer. The schools would have to be air-conditioned during the summer. Right here in Champaign, we have gone through trying to raise the resources through the bond measures and so forth.
And this is a community that's doing pretty well. You look at communities across the state trying to take on something like this, that's going to be really hard.
So it's quite a challenge to retrofit many of the buildings if you're not building new buildings. So being able to have the facilities available, having the kinds of services and supports available that a program like Compass has is tremendous. They feed the kids. There is a level and quality of adult supervision that's there. As she identified, these are certified educators. I think these are additional aspects that challenge the ability of manipulating the calendar in certain ways because there are still attendant costs.
Who needs to lead on this? Who do you think needs to sort of, I mean, there's already examples out there. We're hearing one in Springfield, but it sounds like from what you're saying, there needs to be maybe more of a wider approach, a broader approach, something that ties more things together. Or maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. Who needs to lead on this, do you think?
Well, leadership has to come from every level of government, but particularly at the district level, where educators can be responsive to the kinds of needs that are evident in their particular districts, depending on the resources that are available, but still finding ways to ameliorate it. Again, the collaboration with social agencies, I think, is going to be increasingly important when state budgets are limited. The ability to be able to engage with other agencies like the University of Illinois and other social agencies or non-government agencies in the district to address some of those needs. So I think the educators locally certainly have a role in understanding the population demographic changes, the
And they're experts on their own community needs.
Precisely.
Kind of bring at a moment when the state is not going to have, there are probably not more resources coming from the state at this point.
And we need to make those conditions clear and evident so that our state elected officials are very much aware of the kinds of constraints that the schools are facing and the implications it has for the development of our children. And certainly at the national level, we are clearly in need of being able to develop the kinds of budget strategies that and tax strategies that provide states and locales with the kind of resources needed to address this. And I don't think it's simply an urban issue. The kinds of employment possibilities and opportunity changes that are impacting our small rural towns are creating some of the same kinds of possibilities for learning loss during the summer.
Well, I think the example you started with, well, you didn't mention the town, but it sounded like you said it was nearby.
So it is.
A downstate community, you know, certainly well outside of a major metropolitan area.
And it's a downstate needs. Small community that is also impacted by diversity. And those bring a set of challenges to the schools also. So having the resident expertise and the resources to be able to address it remains a challenge. But I don't think it's any one level of government that that could or should assume the responsibility for addressing it.
Sarah, coming back to you here, and we've only got about a minute left, but Sarah, can you tell me from your perspective with the work you're doing there in Springfield, what is sort of the greatest need for you there in Springfield?
For us, we would love to be able to serve more students. We're very lucky this year to have a grant from the Women's Fund at the Community Foundation for the Land of Lincoln that allowed us to expand our program to include 20 more students. But we always have students on our waiting list who want to be part of the program, who have the need. So for us to get more funding to be able to serve more students, that's what we'd like to do, and to have more partners. We're lucky to host our program in the summer at Ridgely Elementary School. They provide our space and the federally funded lunch and so to be able to create those partnerships and get that, you know, special grant funding to serve more students, that's the need we would like to be able to fill.
So a lot, again, coming back to that idea of sort of local resources invested locally to make a difference within the community there. That's Sarah Boyning, you heard there, board president of Compass for Kids. Also talked with Bill Trent, professor and director of the Center for Education in Small Urban Communities at the University of Illinois, talking about getting a better understanding here of summer learning loss. Thank you both for joining us today.
Happy to be able to do it, and thank you for addressing this topic. It's a critical one.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here today. We're just over about 15 minutes away now from Governor Rauner's deadline, high noon, for Democrats to send him the new school funding bill. Little indication at this point that's going to happen, but we're learning more about Rauner's staff shakeup also, and all of it's still playing out in the context of a 2018 election for governor. It's Monday, of course, when we talk state politics, and on the line with us, Sarah Burnett, AP politics reporter based in Chicago, also Tony Arnold, WBEZ political reporter. Both of you, welcome back to The 21st.
All right, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, of course, it's good to talk to you. Tony, let's just start with you here. The governor's been demanding now that Democrats send him this new school funding bill. It's Senate Bill 1 on Friday. Set up this showdown, I guess, with a noon deadline today. He said he'll use as a mandatory veto. We can talk more about all that in a minute. But any signs Democrats are getting ready to send him a bill today?
No, if anything, that looks like the bill won't be sent to him here by noon. I suppose that could change in the next 17 minutes while we're on the phone. The indications are that the Democrats still don't want to send the bill to him because, as the governor said, repeated for the umpteenth time this morning, that he would make changes to it, and the Democrats don't want him to make those changes. So that's why they haven't sent it to him. This morning, the governor did say that, assuming that the bill is not sent and school funding remains in question for the foreseeable future, then he would call legislators back to Springfield on Wednesday in 2 days. But if there's nothing for them to do, I don't know what that session is going to look like, because right now we're just in the middle of yet another stalemate here between the legislative leaders and the legislature and the governor.
And you've got, the Senate president has said, no, let's not call us back. Let's just do a leader's meeting. And right. The governor's people said, no, we're not going to do that. So that's kind of what happens if it's not sent. Sarah, can you kind of remind us what exactly in this bill? What does it do?
Sure. Well, it changes the way that Illinois funds education. Currently, the system relies heavily on this general state aid, which is sort of a flat amount per student sent out to each district. It doesn't take into consideration things like how much other money a district can bring in through property taxes or how many kids with specific needs that cost more to educate there are. So it's created the system where we have huge disparities between wealthy districts and poor districts in Illinois. I believe it's the biggest disparity of any state in the nation. So for the first time, this bill creates a different model for sending out money, and it actually looks at the adequacy of the amount of money that you're getting. So if you are unable to raise other money through property taxes, it takes that into consideration. It also looks at if you have a lot of special ed students or low-income students and the fact that it costs more to educate those. So it distributes money differently. It also increases money overall. The sticking point here is that it also begins to treat Chicago public schools the same way that the rest of the state is treated in regard to the pensions.
And there's the root of this whole disagreement in this standoff there. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, maybe. I mean, reporters again today tried to get the governor to outline specifically what it is that he doesn't like, whether it's the pension money for Chicago or this other money that's referred to as the block grant money that Chicago also gets. And, he's kind of gone back and forth. It's been unclear what it is he has the issue with. And again today, he just said, I'm not, send me the bill and I'll let you know what it is.
Tony, go ahead.
My question to him was, what else would you change? Would you do anything else besides address the amount of money going to Chicago public schools? And even then, we still don't know which part of Chicago public schools money he would change. And his answer was, well, that would be the bulk of it. So what else is in there? We don't know yet, and we don't have the language to see exactly what he would be doing.
And there is general agreement on most of the actual school funding parts of this. It got bipartisan support, addressing a lot of those the issues that Sarah was talking about there a minute ago. But it sounds like even at this point, very unclear exactly what the sticking points are, at least on the side of Governor Rauner.
Well, I think, this goes into just where we've been for the last, 2.5 years since Governor Rauner took office. It's he's been talking on and on about the conditions at Chicago Public Schools not being good. It's why people leave the city of Chicago, and he's got some ways to address that. None of those ways have been addressed by the legislature, though, which is, you know, plays into everything else that's been going on here. So what Rauner is saying today is, why would you put money toward Chicago Public Schools pensions when you could put that money toward schools in other parts of the state? But Chicago Public Schools pensions are terribly underfunded after years of skipping payments and many other reasons. So this is all playing into, you know, the whole, you know, the whole impasse that we've seen for the last 2 years as well.
So just briefly, Tony, I mean, the timeline here. I mean, school does start fairly soon here. You know, when does school's funding need to be in place? What are we looking at here? What are the stakes?
I believe August 10th is the first, is when schools would normally receive paychecks from the state of Illinois. So that's we have 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks from now. That's the beginning of it. Now, if you have one lesson learned from the state budget impasse is that every place is a little different, has a little different finances. Some places have more in reserves in the bank than others do. So would every school not be able to open come, you know, the end of August when they're supposed to? Not necessarily. Some are in better shape than others. But there would be some schools that probably would not be able to open their doors at the beginning of the year for the first day of school. And then as it drags out, that would just increase. That number would just increase.
You know, just we had talked last week with one school superintendent in Southern Illinois, Wes Olson. He is in favor of SB 1. You know, Governor Rauner had argued last week that superintendents have been intimidated into supporting the bill. We brought this up with Superintendent Olson. Let's just hear what he had to say.
You know, as a superintendent, again, and this isn't a political statement, I'm not afraid of the governor. I don't think we're afraid of the speaker. What I am afraid of is telling the 2,000 students and families that we have here that they can't come to school.
So what, and I'll throw this to either of you. I mean, what are either of you hearing anything from superintendents right now, particularly in the Chicagoland area?
No, I've been hearing anything like that. In terms of, I think most would bristle at the governor's reaction that this is that they're supporting Senate Bill 1 out of any kind of political retribution or political fear from one side or another. I think schools have been trying to stay, you know, party neutral and not declare sides here, but that is a little bit of what this debate is creating, right?
And schools are stuck in the middle in a lot of ways. I mean,
they're stuck in the middle, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, many of them have advocated for a different way of funding schools, and so I've seen several of them, like on Twitter, for example, you know, saying like, just we need something. The thing to remember also in all this is that what the governor is threatening is an amendatory veto, which effectively would veto the entire bill, because there aren't the votes to override the veto and there aren't the votes to sustain or concur with what the changes he's making, which would have to be done.
Yeah, and Sarah, I mean, just to back up for a second, just sort of civics lesson. I mean, a mandatory veto, can you explain that?
Sure. So in an amendatory veto, it goes back to the legislature after he makes the change. They either have to override him by 3/5, which is what we saw with the budget, or by a simple majority, they have to agree with the change that he made. If they can't do either of those things, the whole bill is vetoed. So and the Republicans don't have enough votes right now to agree, the simple majority.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a simple majority. The Democrats, it sounds like, don't have the bill. You know, they needed Republicans with them on the budget override. I'm not sure that they have that. I don't believe that they do. So it effectively the whole bill would be vetoed, which would result in nobody getting any money. And so his action would basically accomplish the same thing that he's accusing them of doing by not sending him the bill, if that makes sense.
No, it does. So the governor would sort of pick out the parts, and we don't yet know what those parts are exactly yet, but the parts that he wants to remove or change from that bill, it would go back in then to the legislature. They have to take it up, and those are some of the options, and it's very unclear at that point what the outcome would be or exactly what the numbers are lined up one way or another. You know, just again, looking at the clock, I mean, it's almost noon here, but, you know, still no sign that that bill's going to head over to his desk by his deadline, what he declared was his deadline. You know, what should folks be looking for on this topic the next couple of days?
Well, I think what the question now is, are we going to have this staring contest that's going to go on, and we're going to bring a bunch of lawmakers back to Springfield and have them, basically do nothing for a couple of days? Or is somebody in leadership, the governor, whomever, going to, sit down and figure out a different way to handle this?
So shifting topics here a little bit, just in the few minutes we have left, and Sarah, I'll stick with you here for just a minute here. Another related topic, the state does finally have a budget. It's about 3 weeks ago now, I guess. There's still many billion-dollar backlog of unpaid bills. Do we know at this point who's getting paid from the state, who isn't, where all that stands?
There is money flowing. The comptroller was out last week visiting some college campuses to announce that they were starting to get money for the first time in a long time, the money for the MAP grants, which is the student tuition assistance grants, has gone out. Some of the social service agencies are getting their money. Obviously, what we're hearing from them is that it's going to take a while before they recover from what happened and before all the bills are paid. The bulk of those bills, about $6 billion, the plan for paying them down, keep in mind the backlog is close to $15 billion when they pass the budget. The bulk of those are going to be paid down through new borrowing. The state is planning to issue bonds in the fall, I believe in September, to get a lower interest rate to pay down the bills that they are currently paying, something like 12% per year interest on the overdue bills.
And then it's up to the comptroller to continue to figure out where those money goes first and what order priorities, things like that.
Correct.
All right. Tony, last week we had talked a little bit about some of the shakeup on Governor Rauner's staff after the budget was signed. One big change includes a couple of hires from the Illinois Policy Institute. Governor hired new chief of staff, policy director, communications director. You spoke with their CEO of the Illinois Policy Institute last week. Can you kind of explain a little bit about the Illinois Policy Institute and what these new hires could signal about what we could see coming out of the governor's office, at least for the next few months?
Yeah, I think it's important to note why people were quitting as more Policy Institute employees were being hired into the governor's staff. Some of those former staff members came from Republican officials who like to say that they were moderates, Judy Bartopinka or U.S. Senator Mark Kirk. And the Policy Institute is an advocacy group that advocates in many different ways for essentially very small government and much lower taxes than what Illinois has. By many measures, very conservative policies. So they do this by they have newspaper columns, they have radio broadcasts, they have a lobbying arm to write legislation in Springfield and work with state lawmakers, and they have a legal arm that challenges state laws in court, including one about paying union fees or another about same-day voter registration are two laws that they've challenged in court.
Yeah, so they got a big outreach, and they're fairly well-known. They seem to be very good at sort of spreading that message. Now, just in the minute that we have left here, what do you think it tells us about the governor's office here going forward, at least until the election?
John Tillman is the CEO of the Policy Institute, and he said that he doesn't expect the new hires from the Policy Institute to change the governor's minds on any policies, but instead change how he gets the word out about his policies. So it's all going to be about messaging, not just in terms of what you see on TV and ads, but also in how he addresses the news media. And Tillman said over and over again throughout the interview that the news media in Chicago and Springfield live in a bubble and aren't very curious about the financial solutions to the state of Illinois. So that's something that I expect to start seeing more of from the governor's administration.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out. Coming up again on an election next November here, some of the strategic and tactical changes that we might see leading up to that. That's Tony Arnold, WBEZ political reporter, also joined by Sarah Burnett, AP politics reporter based there in Chicago. Thank you both. It was nice to talk to you.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today here. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. You can find links, directions to how to find us on Alexa, every other way to contact us, phone, email, social media. That's all over at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Just search for 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with analysis, background about what we're talking about over on our Facebook page. Search for the 21st to like us there. You can comment on what we're working on, post questions or comments that you might want to ask us on the air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction, engineering support comes from Jason Croft and from Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.